Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to His Darker Materials, the unofficial companion podcast to the official His Dark Materials show on HBO and BBC. I'm Dave Corkery, and as always, I am with Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about episode 3 of season 3 of His Dark Materials. There will be spoilers for everything up to and including that episode, and there may be some book spoilers in the interviews that you will hear shortly from the wonderful cast and crew of the show. So be warned. Helen, what did you think of episode 3?
Yeah, this was, I think, probably a slightly kind of smaller scale episode in some ways after the big kind of confrontation, you know, airships and troops and gunfights and rampaging polar bears last time. You know, this one's a lot more people talking in rooms in a good way. That is not a bad thing to have good characters talking. But I feel like, you know, we've got Lyra and Will back together after their long separation. We've got them kind of reestablishing and their relationship and figuring out what their next move is. We've got, really excitingly, Lord Asriel and Mrs. Coulter reunited
for
a significant amount of time and a significant amount of kind of meaty drama, which is just
they stole this episode.
Oh, they really did. Yeah, this is a super good episode for the two of them. And I think, you know, a lot of that is in the books. You know, she does get captured in the book. Obviously, she does get brought to his stronghold and stuff. But it feels like they've really developed it and deepened it in the show, which I'm just living for right now. I'm living for the drama.
Well, let's get right into that, because let's start there. So on the Asriel camp, yeah, we get right into it. Mrs. Coulter is being kept in a storage unit, and then she gets upgraded to a chair with rope. And then it's a progression in this episode, you know, but she starts at a storage unit, and by the end, she's stolen a spaceship and she's off. We get a load of interesting, as you say, interactions between the two of them. And they're really, like, there's a playfulness, isn't there, there's a flirtatiousness between the two of them.
There's clearly still an attraction. I feel like both of them are aware that this is maybe the only other person in the world who's on their level in terms of just capacity for great things, in the sense of large things rather than the sense of good things.
Good.
You know?
Yeah.
But in the sense of being able to sway others to their cause, in the sense of being very, very, very bright, very powerful, charismatic personalities, there's kind of neither of them has anyone like the other. And there is still some kind of element of attraction, I think, certainly on his part. I don't know. She's obviously harder to read because that's her whole thing. And that's probably part of the reason that he is so attracted to her, because I suspect he's used to people falling at his feet and indeed takes it as his due. Their interaction is inherently great. And I think that's part of the reason that he just trusts her, when every single part of him and every single thing in the world should be telling him, absolutely don't trust her. But he still, like, he wants to believe that she's on his side, and he's arrogant enough to believe that he can win her over and win her allegiance.
Well, he even says that in the line, you know, it's like, why can't you be who I want you to be? It's like, even though he knows she can't, he still wants her to fall in line, as you said.
Yeah.
He knows she's going to betray him.
He must know, right?
He knows she can't be trusted. He does.
Yeah.
But even to the point where he outsources it. He knows he can't trust himself either. So he kind of outsources it to his council. He's like, look, I can't even trust my own judgment here. So you guys decide. And naturally, she kind of wins them over as well. Even Ruta, who's like from the off, is like, we should kill her. She's killed all these witches. Even she kind of gets won over, you know, and she cleverly, connivingly convinces all of them that not only is she on the same side as them and she's got the same goal, but that she's kind of just a good mother underneath it all, whether or not that's true.
It's one of these things where she will use a degree of honesty to sell the lie.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So she talks about the fact that she, you know, I didn't think of her for years. I gave her up. I didn't think of her for years. Didn't care. Wasn't interested. And it was, if, you know, if I did, it was only to regret the embarrassment of her birth.
That's such a good lie.
But now I care. And I think those things are both true, actually. And yeah. Then the lie. So now I'm totally with you guys because you guys are my best chance of keeping her alive.
Yeah.
When the fact is she's totally with herself as the best chance of keeping Lyra alive. And she will totally use whatever means necessary to secure her safety and her daughter's safety.
Exactly. And the funny thing is she's not even subtle about it in the second half of this episode. She's like, hey, look at these blueprints. They're nice. Where do you keep all these things? But it's like, and even Ruta's like, yeah, right. But like what really did bother me about this episode is like, why you're going to let, fine, you've decided as a group, we're going to let her roam around the camp freely, right? And if she tries to leave, you know, well, there'll be trouble. But let's not put any security on the most important bit of equipment we have, that, you know, the interdimensional starship. Like,
Yeah, that was a choice, wasn't it? That was an odd choice. I guess there may have been an element of Azrael playing himself there, sort of, if I put more security on it, it'll only draw her attention. Like, if I lock a door, maybe that's the door she'll want to go through. And as he says at the end, it's only the second most powerful piece of equipment. He's got a better intention craft that he's been working on.
That's true. He does seem largely unfazed at the end. He's very much like, you go off, have your Lyra adventure. She doesn't even matter anyway. And I thought that was interesting. He keeps coming back to Lyra's unimportance. It's almost like he's trying to convince himself, you know, because that's all religious mumbo jumbo, you know, and it's just like, if they're right, then he can't be right, you know. And I think that's what gets him.
That's really interesting. Absolutely. Yeah. If they believe she's Eve and they are wrong about everything, then they must be wrong about that. So why do I keep hearing her name like it matters when it clearly doesn't? Because you're right, almost, if she matters, then that means they're right about something, and that he can't even countenance that possibility.
Exactly, because that implies fate and prophecy and all these things that are intangibly linked with faith and belief and religion, and that is what he is opposed to. So yeah, and I think that is why he has this guttural reaction to this prophecy, to this Lyra being this thing, and he tries to ground it in like, how could you and I create Eve? You know, we're just people, and it's just a. So I think James McAvoy is sensational in this episode, as is Ruth Wilson. And just it's when they're on screen in front of the intention craft during that whole scene, it was just, I could have world-class stuff. Like.
It really is. And I think it's interesting that, as a few of our interviewees have talked about, in any normal story, these two titanic personalities would be the hero and heroine, or the hero and villain, however you want to figure it out. And in this, they're very, very important, but they are supporting characters in a girl's journey. And there is something just so exciting and so groundbreaking, so weird about that, that makes His Dark Materials what it is. But yet, seeing them on screen together in these roles, in these just titanically powerful, I think there's an arrogance to both of them. I think it's more obvious in his case, but there is an arrogance to her as well. This belief that she can basically overwhelm anyone with her guile, with seduction, with deception, with manipulation, whatever it takes, she has it. And there's a self-confidence there. You know, it's shaken a little bit more than his is, I think, occasionally, but not by much. And so just to see them kind of just sparking off each other, it is kind of the, you know, immovable object meets the unopposable force. Yes. A little bit between the two of them.
Exactly. And I think when they get to that interrogation scene as well, you see how far both of them are willing to go to get what they need. You know, we spoke about it in the last episode, the sort of the hint of relish that Lord Azrael has with that torture. There's almost like he's enjoying it. It feels like he's really reveling in it. In this one, in the pain of the angel. And I think I think the show's always been really good at telling us, using the demons to tell us how a character is feeling. And I loved the touch that Mrs. Coulter sends her demon outside the room for this, you know, this nasty bit of work that she has to be witness to. And that almost separation of, right, you know, it's a bit like Father Gomez and his pre-penance. It's just like, I gotta do this terrible thing and I'm gonna keep my soul clean of this somehow, or somehow do some mental gymnastics to convince myself that this is okay.
Yeah, and I feel like her relationship to her demon, we talked about that a lot last season and in season one, but her relationship to her demon does feel like it's changing a little bit now. Like the unnamed golden monkey is, there's a little bit more sort of communication between them on a level almost, you know. So those scenes last week where they were at the window and sort of looking at each other like, okay, we're going to figure this out. You know, it feels like they're maybe more united a little bit than they were before, that she's struggling less against her own soul now, maybe. And maybe that's just because she's allowed a little bit of love into her heart, a little bit of love into her life. There's a sense of redemption's probably too strong a word for Mrs. Coulter, but there's a sense of, you know, growing openness to something, to Lyra, obviously, but just to some kind of intangible quality that she has absolutely been sometimes violently repressing and pushing away before. You know, the kind of the abuse she showed her demon in the past does seem to be gone at the moment, like that, and sending him out of the room for that moment is absolutely the, you know, a way to show that.
I agree with that. That's really well observed. The demon is a bit more complicit, or they're a bit more, yeah, it's more of a team rather than he was more servant like in the previous ones, wasn't he? Yeah,
very much so. Yeah, ordering him around, like, and sending him on you know, tasks and so on, and even now, you know, even with the violence last episode, even with him literally bringing down a rock on her head, it was more a joint decision. It was more a joint, this needs to be done, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Rather than being a command and a sort of reluctance like we've seen from them before.
And I think that the change is due to her change in mission, right? I think she is determined this season just to get to Lyra, keep Lyra safe, be a good mother, right? Now, we've spoken about her methods being all over the place, but like, that is her goal. Whereas previously, she was for the most part in service of the Magisterium and, or kind of herself, but to the, you know, to the ends of the Magisterium, which is kind of all she knew. And I think that inherently goes against sort of her soul or her demon. And now, yeah, they have a goal that I think that they can unite on.
Yeah, exactly that. There's that great line, the one about honesty is not a thing to be found. You're either honest or you're not. And neither of us are. That, I mean, true.
I like that.
Yeah, that was very good. I just love the complexity of them both and the way you see that when they're together. They know each other well. They can call each other on their bullshit to a point. But she has fundamentally changed since the last time he saw her. And it's kind of interesting seeing him grapple with that.
Yeah, she has changed, but she is still not honest, right?
And still that's what she's honest, saying.
And she's,
still,
and she's like, what I loved about her is that she, you know, she wins. She has won over the council. She can walk around this camp. And they ask her a straight up question, you know, do you know about this knife? And she's like, knife? What knife? Never heard of a knife. It's like straight into the lying. Like, but like, she just kind of knows she can just confidently lie her way out of anything. I thought that line was really good about the honesty. And it works really well with Lyra's line about the doubt. You know, she said that something along, you know, the my parents and the people who have no doubt, you know, they tend to be the bad people, because people, if you doubt yourself, you are questioning things and thinking things through. And I think it's a similar thing in that there's these, you know, Azrael and Coulter, they're all about absolutes. You know, I'm either honest or I'm not honest. I'm either, you know, X or I'm Y. You're either on the side of fighting against the authority or you're not. Whereas Lyra and Will question everything and kind of find, you know, what is the real answer? And it's that inquisitiveness that resets them apart, I think.
Absolutely. It's the openness to change, you know, and
yes.
And I think actually, you know, Lyra perhaps underestimates her parents. I think both of them ultimately will change at least a little bit. But it's a real contrast with somebody like Father Gomez or Father MacPhail, who will absolutely not change at all. It's absolutely right. You've got to keep your open mind. You've got to be open to the world and open to learning new things and having your assumptions challenged. And Lyra and Will, I think, are young enough that they have that. Having said that, Lyra is not the world's greatest poster girl for either openness to new ideas. When she gets an idea in her head, she is very fixed on it. That's and true. Also, she is famously dishonest. She is her mother's daughter in many ways.
That, well, you've just described both of her parents' characteristics.
Well, true.
Yeah.
Well, he claims not to lie. To be fair, he claims to a good way that he doesn't lie.
I thought that was interesting. Is that true? It kind of is. I think he does. He does bad things, but he's never, you know, he's quite open about the bad things he does.
He's pretty open about. I mean, he didn't, you know, tell Lyra he was going to kill her buddy, but he didn't promise him safety. I don't think either. I'm going to have to go back and watch season one, maybe. But he's.
I didn't not say I would kill him.
It would be a weird thing to say, though, wouldn't it? Oh, please come in, make yourselves at home. I definitely won't kill your buddy. You know, it would sound weird. All right. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Amir Wilson, who, of course, plays Will Parry. He started off really as a sort of child actor on this show. He has since appeared in TV and films, often with a fantasy bent. But he is now a grown up, going into proper grown up acting. And you get to see that transition, I think, here on screen in season three. As ever with our interviews, this goes with spoilers right up to the end of the season. So please do tread carefully if you haven't finished watching it yet. But otherwise, please enjoy Amir Wilson. So, Amir Wilson, welcome back to his darker materials. How are you feeling after a 2-year gap? How's it? You know, how's life? How's things?
Oh, things are great. You know, I finished on his dark materials coming up to a year ago now. Mm-hmm. I think it's like around the year ago mark, around now actually, which is mad to think about because I remember starting the show, filming season three, and it was like, oh, this is going to be a long 7 months, and then got to the end of it, and it was like, where did all that time go?
What
it's
just
like
happened?
We just created a series, but it's like this is all described. Been one big blur almost. It's a relief. You do your thing on set and you just hope it goes well, and obviously the rest is out of your hands. Mm-hmm. And then you just hope when it comes out that people like what they see, you know.
Yeah. Do you remember your first time like reading this book first of all, and then reading this script? Mm-hmm. You know, had you read the book a long time ago? I can't remember if you were the one of the ones who'd read ahead in the books or you were trying to wait with the series.
So I read kind of in a funky order because I was working on something else like a week before I started doing this, and I hadn't read any of the books. At the start, when I got the role, I hadn't read any of the books. I'd heard about it and I'd seen The Golden Compass, but I hadn't read any of the books. And so just to like keep myself up to date, I read The Subtle Knife first.
Right.
Like kind of like as I was doing all my stuff in season one, all of the World stuff, I was kind of reading Subtle Knife as that was happening. And then I read The Northern Lights.
Right.
And then I read The Amber Spyglass.
Of course, the natural reading.
Yeah, of course, as you do. If I'm being truthful, I wouldn't really go back to the books a lot during filming, I think, because I trust that the script was kind of doing its job in being faithful for the books, but also because it was important for me to understand that Will's a lot younger in the books. I think on the blurb of my book it said he's about a 13-year-old kid or a 12-year-old kid. And obviously we were playing, I think, 15, 16-year-olds. Obviously it's not a big age difference and obviously still young, but it's I think in teenage years, 13 to 15 or 16, it's quite a big gap.
Yeah, it feels like a big difference.
It does feel like a big difference. Obviously, I love the books, but it was. I spent a lot of time looking at the script material whilst I was filming because that was kind of what I was trying to stay loyal to.
Mm, yeah. The Amber Spyglass in particular goes to big places, like cosmic, you know, battles between heaven and earth, all of this kind of mind-blowing stuff, frankly. So was there anything in there where you're like, how are we going to do this? What's that going to look like?
Oh, yeah, there was a bunch. Well, the Land of the Dead stuff, I kind of didn't know how that was all going to come together with the harpies and stuff as well. I was like, you know, where do you even start with this? Which is why just leave it to Jane Schranzer and all of the big bosses to kind of sort it out. I mean, look, I think the actors on this show are lucky because everything kind of just falls into place. These guys do all the hard work and then we turn up with a script and a ready-made set and we kind of just like everything's ready and already planned out for us. I can't imagine what it was like for these guys to figure out some of the complications in this story and in this book. Because there's a lot of detail and there's a lot of things that go on, a lot of questions that need to be answered, and it's I think by the time it gets to episode 8, everything kind of comes into a full circle. Mm-hmm. And those questions are maybe answered and things are kind of revealed in a sense. Land of the Dead was kind of a big thing. I was like, whoa, how are we going to do this? And also the paradise stuff, obviously we ended up going to Spain, which felt like paradise. So it was lucky to be doing my job whilst being in Spain. It's like a dream.
I'm guessing, especially after the, I think the pandemic had happened before that. So you'd been locked up for a year. And then suddenly, hey, we're filming in Spain.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, there was talk about going away to film to do Chitagatsi. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it didn't happen. We spent it all in the Cardiff backlot, which is, again, was incredible because it's like Joel Collins and everyone who was involved in designing these sets did like an amazing job. It's like I have no way to describe it. So for us as actors, it's like when they said action or when we were kind of walking in and out of these sets, as soon as they dimmed the lights and added a bit of smoke and fog, it really felt like it was just, and we were lucky enough not to spend all of our days standing in front of a green screen, which is what people often assume you're doing when you're filming a fantasy show or a show that's heavily visually put together.
Yeah. You've done quite a few different fantasy stuff.
Most of the things I've done have been fantasy.
Is that where your interest lies, or is that what's happened?
Now it's not where my interest lies, I tell you that. I'm filming a BFI film next year, which is a drama based in London, which would be the first thing I've done that isn't kind of fantastical. And filming fantasy is great because it really makes you use your imagination, which is kind of the best thing about fantasy. It's like you spend all day just imagining stuff. As you get older, you lose your creativity, I think. Not me personally, but I just think in general, obviously, you have everyone's kind of full of creativity as a young child, as a younger kid. And then as you grow up, it kind of gets dimmed down through school and whatever. But it's nice when I do these fantasy projects that I get to kind of tap into that younger me of like, you know, it feels like I'm just playing dress up as a kid and I'm kind of running about my room type of thing.
Yeah. Tell me about, we meet Will's demon this season, right? Mm-hmm. So what was it like, actually kind of, you know, getting to play that?
I kind of felt left out. Everyone had a demon and I didn't. And everyone was kind of, what's all this demon talk about? Obviously, I'd had a couple of scenes with Pan, but it was nice to get my own demon. And Bobby, who puppeteers my demon, it was obviously brilliant. She's a brilliant puppeteer, and all the puppeteers on this job are kind of brilliant because they give you enough to make you feel like you're able to give a good performance. Yeah. It's not just like these guys stand there with puppets. It's like these guys are, there's obviously dialogue that they're reading. And obviously it gets voiced over in the end by certain different actors, but it's like we're lucky enough to have these people on set so that are kind of helping us navigate, and they're there and they you work with them. It's not like they'll be like, oh, is it easier if I go here or here? And obviously they tell you, you know, where it's best to put your hand for visual effects reasons and probably money reasons as well. It's kind of, I don't know how much it costs to stroke a demon in visual effects money, but I can imagine it's probably quite a lot. But no, it was cool to be able to have a demon and be able to do more scenes with demons.
Yeah. And having something like that to play off makes such a difference. I have interviewed Kermit the Frog.
Yeah.
So, and I find myself talking to Kermit, even though I could see Steve Whitmire behind him, you know, because it's a really good puppeteer, it's incredible.
I don't think I could do it. It's a talent to be able to do it to a good ability. Definitely.
Yeah. What about the Malefas and so on as well? I mean, you've got big challenges this season.
Exactly. I mean, there's obviously, as you would know, there's just like so much more going on this season. More characters, more creatures, more worlds. And all of that was just kind of a delight for me. Season two was obviously very Chitagatsi based, which is great. But it was really exciting. I had the most fun filming this because it was like just such a bigger scale and there was so much more going on. Mm-hmm. It was just something new and different going on every day, which is like a blessing for me.
And it felt like in these first two episodes especially, you know, Will is literally traveling across worlds, you know, meeting angels, fighting polar bears, and Daphne's just asleep. Well, yeah, you know,
and I pulled the short straw. I had to do all this traveling. Daphne spent the first two episodes sleeping. Lucky her. It was fun. We filmed Burn White World, I remember, where I first kind of have an interaction with the angels and they tell me about the knife and I tell them that I'm not going with them. That was filmed at like a quarry, I think just outside of, I think it's in Wales or maybe just in Bristol, Bristol. Not too far away though. And it was a clay quarry, but it was really hot that day. So they had these, obviously it's a clay quarry and the white reflecting into my eyes. So I remember just like, there were action and I was kind of just like squinting, like I can't even do this right now. And obviously Cobner Simon, who played Baruch and Bathamos, brilliant and so lovely as well. I had a joy filming with these guys.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was going to ask as well about Will. Obviously, went through. Well, Will has basically been through trauma every season. Yeah. Will, Will's life has never been easy. But I think you see the echoes of that already in these first two episodes. You know, he's dealing with the death of his father, mm-hmm. found him and lost him almost in the same breath, and then all Mrs. Coulter has to do is bring up his mum, yeah, and it exactly. just completely throws exactly. him again. You know.
Yes, I mean, I always feel bad for. It's like he has like the best and worst moment of his life with his dad all in the space of 5 minutes. He sees his dad and thinks his dad's dead his whole life. And at the end of season two, you know, it's obviously, yeah, as you said, you touched it, but it's traumatic for him. And these experiences which change you, which is why it was important for me to establish a new and stronger Will going in, because it's like in real life, your experiences do change you, and they do, for the better or for the worse, you know, make you a stronger person. But you know, he sees his dad, and within 5 minutes his dad dies again in front of him. His dad obviously gives him the kind of the dying message, the dying wish of delivering this knife to Asriel. He goes back to tell Lyra, and she's gone as well. It's like two important people in his life gone within minutes. It's tough, but it was definitely, I think, when we pick up Will in season three, he's had time to reflect on his emotions. Not that they still affect him and stuff, but he's definitely had time to reflect and kind of come to terms with maybe some of the things that's happened with him. And that was important just for me to understand that, yeah, it's a new and stronger Will, more grown up version. I'd obviously grown up as well.
Yeah.
But it's fun to be able to do that.
Yeah. And you get the sense that he's, you know, having essentially been on this one quest to find his dad for a while, he's now given himself another,
yeah.
like just to give him something else to focus on. Like, yeah. now I've got to find Lyra. Yeah, and then exactly. then we can talk exactly. about whatever well, yeah, else you want to talk about.
That's
you
know? What came, yeah, it was like the decision of whether he had the option of, well, he had the alethiometer and he had the knife. He had the option of going straight to Asriel, or he had the option of finding Lyra. And he picked the moral decision, you know, which I think I admire Will for that. Mm. I wouldn't have.
just get take this stuff away from me. Let me go.
I have alethiometer and a knife. I do not need Lyra. No, I do think that's one of the best things about Will, though, his morality and how he's so selfless. He really puts other people in front of him.
Yeah.
I think that's like such a good thing to take away from a character.
Absolutely. And the relationship between him and Lyra.
Being able to do that was fun as well. Kind of establish the relationship between Will and Lyra. I feel like it's talked about it being more, you know, everyone assumes it's kind of this lovey-dovey thing, and it's like, it's not really. What it really is two friends who then maybe realize that they might be something more than friends, but they are just friends. So like, yeah. even when he sees her for the first time again, it's not like, oh, he's in awe of this girl. It's like, I'm so happy to have my friend with me again,
yeah.
kind of be with this person. I think that's the reason they both have traumatic experiences, and they feel like they can trust one another, which is the great thing.
It's weird, actually. Somebody was saying to me yesterday that James Cameron was giving a story class, and he was saying you can't show two people on screen falling in love. All you can show is two people learning to trust each other.
Yeah,
that's essentially the same thing, yeah. but it's a, you know, that's something you can actually illustrate, yeah, which I think exactly. is lovely between them. What about new cast members this season? Who did you have to work with? Obviously Baruch and the Angels, but who else?
Yes, well, I worked with Joe Tanberg for the first time. He plays Yorick Bernison, and he's absolutely incredible. His ability to, he's a Norwegian, but his ability to like just switch into this big voice. He doesn't sound, his natural voice obviously doesn't sound like Yorick at all, but his ability to switch into these voices, like it's nothing. It's like, I'm in awe of it. I couldn't imagine doing it. Working with him was great. I got along with him on and off screen. I go climbing with him a lot.
Hey,
I'm a big rock
cool.
climber, so he's into climbing as well. I was going to go see him a couple months ago in Norway, but things didn't work out. Schedules just kind of didn't allow that to happen. I worked with Ruth for the first time kind of directly. We had obviously I see her in season two, and we have that thing in Boreal's house, that kind of like escape mission type of thing. I had a scene with Ruth, and working with Ruth she's just incredible, because Ruth a lot of the time plays these really serious roles and serious characters and these strong characters, but off camera she's just really, really lovely and like a kind of a pleasure to be around. I admire her work, and I admire her ability to kind of switch into these roles like it's nothing.
Yeah. And just finally, because I think we have to finish up, but you're climbing on set. Did you actually break any sets, or was it, you know, just...
I broke the Malefa tree sets. I kind of broke a bit of the fake wood off, which is a bit bad. I tried to like put on something and it ripped off. And on the Land of the Dead set, there was a bunch of stuff that I tried to climb. I just get told a lot off by the ADs. In that Bone White world, there was a mound of clay that I climbed to the top of, and I got shouted at really badly because, I mean, you can't do that. But yes, the stories of me climbing are true, but I blow off steam at the end of the day by going to the climbing centre. There's a lot of climbing. There's a place called Boulders, which is like 5 minutes away from the studio, and there's a place called Rock Block. I'd go there at the end of the day kind of just to blow off steam, because if not, I just think about what I do that day, and it's like you'd end up just sitting and dwelling on, oh, maybe I could have done this, or maybe I could have done that. But I'd go climbing at the end of the day and kind of, it would clear my mind.
Get out of your system. So you're ready for the next, like when Tom Cruise calls for Mission Impossible 23.
When Tom Cruise calls me and asks me to climb something crazy, I will 1,000,000,000% be there, no doubt. I promise.
Awesome. Well, listen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the rest of season 3.
Should we talk about Roger? Should we talk about the land of the dead then?
Yeah, so we get another dream. So Lara's been having 3 episodes of dreams now, and she's dead convinced they ain't just dreams, that this is Roger. She's talking to him. He's in the land of the dead. And she manages to convince Will of the same. And this is interesting because they're reunited at last, and they kind of have a little catch-up and a tete-a-tete. And then it kind of instantly becomes a confrontation because they realize that they have very different objectives.
Yeah, he's figured out, okay, so I've found Lyra now. That was job number one. So job number two is now to do what my dad told me, do what the angels told me even, and go to Lord Azrael with this knife, with the Asahitra. So he's kind of like pretty clear on that. Obviously, he has to fix the knife first, but that's his path as he sees it. And she has become completely convinced of this, of the reality of the land of the dead. It is interesting, like she has reason for that, that the line Pan had about not, he said he couldn't go with her, you know, so that maybe kind of tends to back up her feeling that this is a real place, that this is a real thing. But yeah, it is immediately sort of puts them at odds again. And it's interesting that Lyra ultimately gets her way, that, you know, Will trusts her to that degree. She wants to go to the land of the dead. And ultimately, you know, it takes him a minute, but he is ultimately like, yeah, all right, let's do that then.
And that's back to that whole thing about the doubt, right? You know, they unlike an Azrael or a Coulter, they kind of have the confrontation, they discuss it, they kind of figure out each other's perspectives, and then they choose loyalty and they choose each other, right? And that's something that someone like Azrael does not do, right? He just has a goal and he doesn't care how you get there, and the ends justifies the means, whereas Will and Lyra express loyalty and compassion to their friends above all else. And I think that is another thing that sets them apart.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that Lyra is so loyal to Roger. So first of all, she went to literally the ends of the earth. She went to the Arctic to find him, to rescue him. She enlisted whoever she needed to up to and including armored polar bears yeah. to do that. Secondly, having ultimately failed in that goal, having ultimately seen him die and been powerless to prevent it, she is now determined and to go to the land of the dead, not to particularly rescue him, but to apologize. Like, that is her stated aim. It's to apologize to him. And that to me is fascinating. That is a level of compassion and a level of loyalty that is really extraordinary. She will, you know, go to the end of all the earths in order to try and put things right with her friend and try and help him out however he needs.
It's just for some reason, it's reminding me of that Michael Fassbender Guinness ad. Did you ever see that one?
I don't think I did.
Anyway, he like swims across the Atlantic Ocean to apologize to his brother in a bar in New York. bit of that vibe about it.
I can see that, yeah.
But to get there, obviously, she does need to fix the knife. So we have this whole very rings of power kind of scene with Yorick, Bernison, the bear, the blacksmith, the legend. I do wonder how a creature without hands or opposable thumbs can be the best blacksmith in the world. But they still don't really answer that.
Okay, they shoot around it quite carefully. I like the idea of, you know, showing how he sort of manufactures the little sort of bowl to melt the metal of the pieces and put them back together. You know, there's an element of showing you how he would do it. But yes, it does crucially leave out the bit with the thumbs and the fingers.
How's he picking up tiny, tiny little things?
Yeah, look, I mean, I feel like I don't know is the answer. I don't know.
I need answers. But I did like that Well, conveniently for him, a lot of the work tends to be on Will's side. You know, the focus and the and I think this ties in with how the knife works, right? He needs to be, and that's how it broke, because his doubts came in, and that's, you know, doubt was is the enemy of focus. That's what broke the knife, and reversing it is what fixed the knife. And I think the other interesting thing we saw in the that scene is Will is, you know, he's thinking in that moment where he's trying to focus, and what's important, he's thinking of his father, then his mother comes in, and then ultimately he settles on Lyra and she becomes his focus, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, I thought that was really, really well done. And it does tie in as well to this stuff about Lord Asriel's intention craft in the last episode. You know, your mind isn't focused, the craft works on focus. You need to be intent on your destination or it can't get you there, and your mind is torn. And here he needs to be intent on the knife, and to do that he kind of focuses on Lyra, because she is the one that he is loyal to, and she is the one that he is non-conflicted about. Because I think, you know, his relationship with his mum, which we talked about a lot last season, is central and profoundly important to his character. This idea that he has had to be the adult in the relationship. He's had to be the responsible party. And even, I think, when, and we don't see all of this on screen, but even when she's been healthier, presumably, he's always still been on edge, because what if, you know, she declines again? What if things come back? So that, I think that's the duality. That's the tear in his feelings about his mother. That's why they're so kind of mixed up, and why they kind of take away his intention. Whereas with Lyra, it's completely clear. I trust her. I'm with her. We're going on this journey together. And that's lovely. It's the purity of their relationship, isn't it?
It is nice. And there doesn't seem to be any doubt when it comes to them, right? It is just certainty. So yeah, I mean, and they're together again. They've worked through their difficulties, and they are now off to the land of the dead. And we get a quick glimpse of it in this episode. Well, we'd seen it kind of in the dreams, but it's kind of like a post-apocalyptic
bureaucracy.
Everything's numbered. There's some people wandering down. So I'm quite keen to see more of how they're going to bring this to life, because it was one of the more interesting sort of elements of the book, I thought.
Yeah, I think the way that they've envisaged this is really fascinating. And again, you know, we've talked about the production design on this show before being astonishing, but like, that, it's a difficult thing to do. The land of the dead, what does that look like? Apart from putting a filter on your camera and making everything look a bit drab, like, what do you do? And in fact, they haven't really done that. They've actually gone kind of the other way and made it look, as you say, post-apocalyptic, that sort of green, yellow kind of, it's almost like the way really bad office lights just drain all color from your skin. You know, it's color.
Like that. I've worked there in the land of the dead.
You've worked it.
I've worked in many lands of the dead. Yeah.
I think I did a stint there back in the day as well. Yeah. So I thought that was really effective, because it's not the obvious sort of skulls and crossbones and skeletons and Cerberus and, you know, all the rest.
Who goes there?
Exactly. It's just something grayer and more draining and more depressing. And I think that accords with what Philip Pullman describes in the book. That accords with this idea of a place where people are trapped, that it's more purgatorial than hellish, you know, that it's a kind of a sapping, energy-sucking void of a place. And, you know, it's hard to think of a place more like that than an office.
It's quite reminiscent of the facility in season one.
Oh, very good point.
Mrs. Coulter is running, and we even get a sort of a callback to that in this episode when Dr. Cooper is brought in by Father MacPhail, who was one of the scientists there. And this comes about because, well, firstly, Father Gomez is not dead. Good for him.
Yes, damn it.
He says basically, you know, we are not going to fight, we're not going to get her or win this war with man-made objects or power. So this puts the idea in Father President MacPhail's head to use the tools of his enemy, I would say, in Mrs. Coulter and Asriel. So he's looking for science. Religion is looking to use science to further its ends, basically.
Absolutely. As long as it accords with what we think is true, then science is a-okay.
Yeah.
But only that far.
Or he'll sweep it under the rug.
This
does feel like a black ops religious mission, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. I think it does. I think it's interesting that we're seeing, probably happens pretty much in real life, but you're seeing that when one person makes kind of a breakthrough in dust, then suddenly they all follow like dominoes falling. You know, once you've established one thing, then suddenly everything else becomes easier. So, you know, we've gone from essentially Azrael presenting a photo of dust or evidence of dust, sort of season one, episode one, as something revolutionary, something that had only been whispered and talked about before, to both he and Mrs. Coulter weaponizing it by the end of that season and using it in some way and manipulating it in some way. And then, you know, now he's got the intention craft. He's traveling between worlds. There's the knife that we're aware of. You know, it feels like some kind of dam has broken and now this flood of innovation, whether hellish or not, is kind of flowing out.
And that's exactly it. And that's a good commentary on science in our reality as well, right? I mean, as soon as the atom was discovered and all of its implications, we got the atom bomb and et cetera, et cetera. And I think this show is doing a good job of portraying how a wondrous thing such as dust, and I think you're right, coming back to that photo in that first episode, it's so magical. And then by the end, a child has been murdered by this, you know, and now it's being used as a weaponized by the Magisterium. So it is science can be used for evil as much as it has the potential for good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, not a good time for Dr. Cooper, it seems like, but you know.
I love the little touch of her her demon sort of cowering behind her. I love again how they show the dynamics between characters of the demon. We forgot to talk about it in a previous episode, but there's that moment where Father Gomez goes into Fra Pavel to crack the whip, and his finger is like edging closer and closer to his demon in this kind of threatening way to Fra Pavel's demon, and then the demon sort of lowers its head in a sort of subjugated sort of fashion. I think it's just like hats off again to the visual effects team, who are doing a fantastic job with bringing these animals to life, and the puppetry that we know goes into it behind the scenes.
Absolutely. That moment was actually really chilling, because we know the prohibition, we know the taboo on touching another person's demon, and so the fact that he's very close to breaking that taboo is really, yeah, it really shows how ruthless and how unrestrained, frankly, he is in that ruthlessness. He's such a dick. He's just the worst.
All right, so I think we've kind of covered everything, except we do check in with old Mary Malone.
Yeah, she's still having a lovely walk in the country and occasionally writing in a book.
Three episodes in, she's not had much to do, but she's definitely having the best time of any of our characters so far.
I think that's fair. It's not a high bar, I'll be honest. Azrael's probably having a pretty good time as well.
He does seem like he's enjoying himself.
He's like, he's in his element. He's got a bunch of people following his every whim. He's got his ex tied to a chair. I don't know his kinks, but he seems happy about it. You know, he's well on his way to bringing down the authority. You know, he's doing okay. But yes, Mary Malone is definitely having the most conventionally nice time here.
She's just having a pleasant stroll through the woods. She's stopping along the way for a nice cup of tea and a chat, and and off she goes. I thought there was something ominous about her little side quest with the two young women. I thought, something's gonna happen here, it's going a bit sour, but no, it's just nice pit stop.
Just stopped off, had a chat, moved on, you know.
So I think that brings us to the end of,
I think it does, yeah,
episode three.
So presumably next time, Land of the Dead.
I think so. I'm looking forward to that.
Wow, yeah. Exciting stuff. Yeah.
Get your fluorescent lights ready.
just like, I'm just going to put on, honestly, pink bulbs in the house just so I feel okay as they go through it, you know.
Some warm lighting. That's all.
Warm lighting, very warm lighting. At least it's Christmas time. We've all got fairy lights up for Christmas, so
that's true.
Hopefully that will help.
All right, see you soon.
Cheers, see you soon.
His Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our producer and editor is Maddie Searle. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. Our executive producers are Kobe Amanaka and Tom Wally. Our hosts are Helen O'Hara and myself, Dave Corkery. A big thank you to Ian Johnson at IJPR, to Bad Wolf at the BBC, and to all our guests for taking the time to chat to us. If you want to chat to us, you can do it at producers@stripped.media.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.